In December 2007, the Correctional Service of Canada released a policy paper by a panel appointed by the Minister of Public Safety of the day, who was at that time Stockwell Day. The title of this policy paper was A Roadmap to Strengthening Public Safety. The report has been embraced by the Conservative government and the Correctional Service of Canada, CSC, and touted as a script for a transformation agenda for Canadian federal corrections. Until the recent release of A Flawed Compass, a human rights analysis of the roadmap to strengthening public safety, authored by lawyer Michael Jackson and former director of the John Howard Society, Graham Stewart, there has been little, if any, public debate on the 109 recommendations in this report. The panel's roadmap is said to be organized around strengthening five key areas that the panel considered would enable CSC greater safety for Canadians. These areas in the roadmap are offender accountability, eliminating drugs from prison, employability and employment, physical infrastructure, and eliminating statutory release, moving to earned parole. In the following interview with co-author Graham Stewart, we'll be discussing these five keys. Hello, Graham Stewart, and thank you very much for allowing me to have this interview.
My pleasure.
So my first question starts as such. In producing your report, A Flawed Compass, A Human Rights Analysis of the Roadmap to Strengthening Public Security, how did you and your co-author, lawyer Michael Jackson, compile all the information that led you to the conclusions that the panel's roadmap was filled with myths and narrow interpretations to suit their ideology?
Well, we went through the report with a fine-tooth comb. In particular, we were looking for evidence that substantiated the recommendations they made. And it was astonishing how little there was in the report. Major recommendations which would have profound long-term impact for federal prisons in Canada were made without a shred of evidence, just statements of what this panel happened to believe. It's not surprising, and in fact, there's no one who can talk about any issue without having an ideology that's influencing them. But what makes your report credible is whether you can back up your values and your ideas with evidence, with reasons to believe that what you're proposing will actually achieve what you're claiming. Without the evidence, then ideology is just your beliefs, and one ends up in an argument about whether your ideology is better than their ideology. And the reason it took us so long to write our response is we felt that we were going to criticize the panel for its absence of evidence, then it was incumbent on us to provide it as best we could within the confines of the report. So our response to the roadmap was actually twice as long as the original roadmap, but that we thought was crucial. So what we were looking for in that respect was evidence. There's all sorts of research that's been done, and the irony here is as much of the best research has been conducted by the Ministry of Public Safety. They have their own research department within that structure, but they also have a research department within the Correctional Services of Canada, which has produced some of the best research consistently over many decades. And we were left with this strange situation where the evidence we were drawing on to counter the recommendations of the report came from the website of the very ministry that had said that they'd embraced this report. And so we couldn't help but think that in the end, if they were ignoring their own research, that this was really nothing more than some people sitting around coming up with ideas and simply justifying them from the lofty position of having been officially placed on this panel.
Could you explain to our listening audience what is the Corrections and Conditional Release Act, the CCRA?
Well, this is the act that governs the whole process of prisons, parole, community supervision. It's the law within which correctional officials must work. It empowers them to take the steps that they need to work to run the system, but it also limits their powers in areas where it might conflict with other rights or other legal requirements. So, for instance, you know, it spells out the conditions of imprisonment, how people can move from one prison to the next, under what circumstances. It would set out the grounds for people being released on parole, or at least the criteria, and such matters as all that.
In your report, one of the major points that you noted in the panel's roadmap are the proposals to limit human rights for prisoners. In doing this, the panel proposed to change the CCRA to separate basic rights from other rights, to abandon the least restrictive measure standard, and tighten up offender accountability. Could you elaborate on what this means and explain to our listeners what offender accountability is?
Well, there's a lot in that question. Let me start with the idea of separating basic rights from rights. Rights we're talking about here are legally established. They come from the Charter, and they've been interpreted by the Supreme Court of Canada. A right is a right. Panels like this do not have the authority to establish what your rights are. That's established through the Charter and the Supreme Court. So right off, the recommendation that some rights should become privileges that you earn simply fell outside of the Constitution. It was clearly not a mechanism that the Correctional Services of Canada could adopt. And that raised serious problems for us about the whole basis in law for the recommendations that they were making. And it became quite clear in the analysis that was done as they spent very little time, if any, actually looking at the implications of the law. Why is the law the way it is? How did it develop in that way? What kind of Supreme Court decisions and others had influenced its development? And we found that there was nothing there. So we had to then write the history of the law and its development. What is human rights? How do they apply in prisons? And explain the whole thing. Now, a lot of people misunderstand human rights. They understand what it is, or they particularly misunderstand prisoners' rights. They think that there's a law someplace that actually articulates a whole set of rights that only apply to prisoners. And that's really not the way it works at all. What the law says, what the Supreme Court has said, and what the CCRA says is that you retain the same rights of any other citizen when you go to jail, except for those things that are necessarily limited. Clearly, you don't have a right to go where you want. You don't have a right to work where you want. There's all sorts of restrictions when you go to jail. But the idea is that you retain all those rights except that those that can be justified being limited by the Correctional Services of Canada. The court has also articulated what the rules are for limiting these rights. And they're fairly reasonable. They suggest that if you're going to limit a right, you should be able to show that limiting that right is actually necessary to achieve a particular goal. So there's a relationship. You have to show that it's proportional. The limitation of the right does not exceed what's necessary to achieve the goal, and so on. Pretty reasonable stuff, I would think. Out of that comes certain legal notions, and one of that is least restrictive measure. In a prison, there's many, many layers of coercion or confinement that can be applied, from living in a relatively open minimum security prison to being in segregation in the maximum security institution, where you're allowed out of your cell an hour a day, and then only to be in a larger cell, which is for exercise, which is a small courtyard. So there's everything in between, and your life under those circumstances can be dramatically different. So basically, least restrictive means that you don't use more control and coercion than you need to address the situation. Some people, indeed, do need a lot of control, and it can be justified on that basis. But what you can't do is up the punishment just for the sake of punishment. Person is not turned over to the correctional authority to do with as they please. They are expected to operate within the law. Now, the law, the CCRA, identifies what the purpose of a prison is, what the purpose of corrections is, and it says two things. First, it's there to ensure that the prison is a safe and humane environment. And secondly, they're there to provide programs and services that facilitate the reentry of the person into the community as a law-abiding citizen. That's it. That's their purposes. And those are very important. So in effect, if Correctional Services of Canada receives a person, their obligation is to do everything they can to reintegrate the person ultimately into the community as a law-abiding citizen, and in the interim to ensure that the environment they're in is safe and healthy. Those are the fundamental restrictions. Now, there's the reason for that, and this is where the connection that disturbs me most about the report arises. What the minister has been saying is that, well, human rights are nice and fine, but public safety is his major consideration, and as minister, he has to look to that. Our position, and we think we have more than enough evidence to substantiate, is that human rights for those who are in prison or anyone else is not in conflict with a safe society.
And you're speaking about Minister Peter Van Loan, right?
Yes. Yes. It's astonishing that when the issue comes up, he keeps talking past the issue of rights and implies that respecting the rights of prisoners puts the public at risk. No evidence for that. But not only that, it's really quite a frightening notion. If Canada is going to go around the world as it has, insisting in other countries that they respect human rights, but at home, tell the public that respecting human rights can put everyone at risk. And you have the situation where the rights exist on paper, but they may well not be exercised by the government, who doesn't believe in them. And prisoners are the first and easiest target, I think, for those that would want to diminish rights because they're unpopular. But, you know, that's where rights really get measured. We don't know. No one really knows that their own rights are likely to be sustained and respected by a government that will pick and choose when and with whom they're prepared to defend those rights. You know, when we look at things like the laws that protect us, there's really two sets of laws. One is the criminal code, which protects us from others who would hurt us or steal things. They interfere with our rights to our property and to our life. That's a crime by definition. And the other are the human rights laws, which protect us from abuse by our government. And that's not without importance. Some people think that's not necessary. But in fact, if you look at the worst abuses in Canada or anywhere else in the world, it's being committed by governments, not by individuals. So everything from genocide to, in other countries, to things even in Canada, like the internment of the Japanese, the residential schools for Aboriginal children, the sterilization of the mentally retarded, all things in our recent history, which on the big scheme of things was incredibly damaging and beyond what any individual criminal would ever do. But in the case of crime, we have this very substantial network that comes to our aid. If we're hurt, then we have 60,000 police officers, a huge network of police officers. We have crown prosecutors. We have courts who will come to our aid and prosecute without charge. We don't pay for that. That's it's a public service that we expect. If your rights are infringed upon, who comes to your rescue then? The option you have is to go to court, eventually to the Supreme Court. Typically, it takes years and huge amounts of money to get there. So in effect, your rights, there is no easy way of addressing an issue where you think your rights have been abridged. And for that reason, you really want a government, politicians in particular, who really understand the importance of rights. We don't see it as an inconvenience or a nuisance or where the particular ideology gets in the way, but really respect it, because if they don't really respect it, then it's hard to see how the systems they administer will respect it. And if you don't have that kind of, that as part of your culture, part of the assumptions on which you operate, then, in fact, you end up with people, particularly prisoners, who are in institutions where the public has no visible access. So it's a secret environment. The walls keep people out as well as in. They have enormous authority. And they're working with unpopular people. That's a recipe for the development of systems that abuse, unless you've got a system that every day, in every instance, understands that they have an absolute crucial responsibility to ensure that they respect people's rights. My concern is if the minister can't understand that, then how do we expect the guard to understand that, who's working under very difficult circumstances in the back of an institution with people who may not be particularly cooperative or helpful? If you can't do it when you're sitting in the comfort of Parliament, how are you going to do it in the back rooms of institutions? And it seems to me that the kind of message that gets sent into that system is one that can only degrade the commitment to human rights, which is difficult to do in the best of times. But the other aspect of that is we've made a lot of progress in the last 20 years in that respect. It has become part of the expectations and culture, and I'm very concerned, and Michael was as well, of course, that's really being moved away from. The other reason, by the way, that it's really important is that there's a system that abuses people cannot improve people. You cannot have a system that will turn people out of jail better able to live as responsible citizens if they've been subjected to arbitrary abuse. What that teaches people is not that certain behavior respecting rights is moral and appropriate, because that's not been their experience. What they really learn is that it's who's powerful that matters. And that kind of attitude is exactly what leads to crime in the first place. It's an abuse of power. It's a person exercising some kind of power over another person. That's a crime. So I don't believe, and there's all sorts of confirmation of this, that a correctional system cannot correct. It's an absolute prerequisite. It cannot correct if it doesn't respect the rights of individuals, if it doesn't engage them on that basis. That's not enough, by the way. You have to go well beyond that. But that's a premise. That's a starting place.
To get back to the CCRA, when they were speaking about the panel, about tightening up offender accountability, could you explain what that offender accountability is?
Well, some of it is nonsense. Some of it is putting in the act, for instance, that prisoners have to follow the rules. It is prison. There's enormous authority. Aside from that, it is already in the act. So some of it was this kind of nonsense, but the word became much more important, where it translates into really serious implications, is the whole set of proposals they make that would substantially undermine gradual release. The panel seems to see gradual release, parole, and so on, as a form of clemency, where if you do your job, if you keep your nose clean, if you take your programs and follow your correctional plan, then you should get parole. Now, parole is one form of gradual release, I should point out. That can come as early as a third in sentence. But for the last third is statutory release. And this is for people who were not released on parole. They were not considered to have been a good bet. And that was introduced in 1970 by eliminating remission. Remission was time off a sentence for good behavior, essentially. A person could earn a third. So they lost that. They were then required to be supervised from the point where previously they'd been free and clear. I say that because the minister and others keep referring to this as early release. And it's not early release. It's never been early release. It's been extending the period of control. It's a presumptive release, but it's under supervision. You can be required to stay in halfway houses, report regularly to the police, report regularly to a parole officer, get permission to travel to, for all sorts of things. The reason that was introduced was not as a reward for good behavior. It was because we came to understand that it served to reduce crime. It wasn't so much for prisoners that was introduced. It was for us that was introduced. In the end, virtually everybody comes out of jail. So the question for us is, what about those that haven't done that well in their programs? What about those who can't get parole because they've got a serious mental illness? But what about those that remain a risk because they've got a serious alcohol problem? Or what about those that are brain damaged in some respect, or those that are intellectually impaired? That makes it very difficult for them to understand rules. What about those that any number of problems that are beyond their control? Do we want to just say, well, you didn't earn your release, so you're going to sit in jail and then come out at the end without any supervision to walk onto the street and just find your own way, as was the case prior to a statutory release coming into place? Or do we want to say, well, okay, you had this opportunity to earn an early release through parole, which you haven't either been unable to do or unwilling to do. But if you're going to be going back on the street, we want to make sure that we've at least put you through a gradual release program. And why? Because our evidence shows that that's actually effective in reducing crime. It doesn't eliminate it, but it reduces it. Those people being released under supervision are less likely to commit an offense than if they're released free and clear at the end of their sentence without supervision. And so that's what it's about. When you take something like that, a program that has an element of earning release through parole, but also is based on the recognition that we have a problem when somebody leaves jail, and that is whether or not he's going to reoffend. And so the best way to do it is to have that controlled and supervised. Then that's a system that goes well beyond simple notions of giving something, a favor to, or a benefit to someone who doesn't deserve it. That's been completely lost in the recommendations of the panel. And our position is that's not consistent with public safety. That doesn't strengthen public safety. That just turns a prison into a much more coercive environment without any clear benefit. Now, they say, one of the ways they talk about it is what they call an accountability contract. And the whole idea is essentially of a contract. We'll put together a correctional plan, and that usually consists of treatment and cognitive work programs that we think would benefit you.
Is this in regards to, like, you know, how they want to change some wording in the CCRA?
Well, yes. What they want to do is they want to abolish statutory release and replace it with what they call earned parole. Well, for it to be earned, they propose that there's an accountability contract. Here's the contract. You do this, and presumably we'll let you go. Except when you examine it, you realize it's not a contract at all. There's absolutely no obligation to actually let a person go, regardless of what they do with their correctional plan, for the simple reason that the criteria for being released on parole boils down to one criteria only, and that is whether you present a risk to the community. Some people can follow their plan and still be a risk. Other people may not follow their plan, but they're not a risk either. And so the question is whether you keep a person in jail. It's not whether he's done his correctional plan, although that would be relevant. That would be a relevant consideration, and it is considered. But rather, whether or not the person can be released with a reasonable expectation that he would commit a serious crime, except when you get to statutory release at that point, and there still is a provision, by the way, to hold people that are particularly dangerous to the end of their sentence. But at that point, the question is, well, he is coming out. He's coming out in the near future. The average term under statutory release is 8 months. So are we better to do nothing, dump him out, or are we better to put him into a gradual release program? And that was the decision that was made in 1970 and has been a fundamental backbone of our gradual release system ever since. In fact, 2 out of 3 who are released from prison are on statutory release, far more than parole. The impact of having 2 out of 3 serve at least another 8 months is staggering in terms of its impact on the federal prison population. That in itself then begins to undermine all the other recommendations and all the talk about accountability contracts and programs and so on. If you start quickly and dramatically increasing the prison population, it becomes increasingly difficult to provide the very programs that you say are going to be the basis on which people are released. And so you end up with what's already a serious problem of getting access to programs, being able to complete them, not having them interrupted with transfers and so on. can only be made worse in an overcrowded system.
The panel's analysis is that the conditions of confinement for those prisoners in voluntary segregation are too soft and need to be toughened up. What is your response to this, and who chooses to go to voluntary segregation?
Well, first of all, you can't just choose to go to voluntary segregation. It's not an option. You have to meet certain criteria. In most cases, you're screened by corrections. The most common criteria they have for putting a person into segregation is his safety or her safety. Now, this is not punitive segregation. This is not where you've gone to be punished. This is where you're going to be protected. Now, the circumstances are very similar. But the option of going there is not something that a prisoner can just ask for. He can say, I'm at risk, I feel that I'm threatened, but the corrections then will make an assessment, and not infrequently it's refused. So the reason a person goes into segregation is not because it's soft. If you can imagine, it living alone for years is far from soft. In fact, it's incredibly stressful environment to be in, and people choose it because they're afraid. They're in an environment where they believe, sometimes for very good reasons, that their life and safety is at risk. That's the criteria. Corrections, in turn, is supposed to be making every effort to find a way to return you to general population. Sometimes it means moving you to a different prison. Sometimes it means moving somebody else to a different prison. Sometimes it means putting some other kind of measure in place, moving where you're located in the prison even can make a big difference. But that's what it's about. People don't go there because it's soft. And this notion that people are picking segregation just so they don't have to work, they don't have to participate, I think is a complete distortion. Making the conditions worse in segregation, where you already have nothing, means that nothing in the sense of active participation in things, means really that you need to make things worse means that you have to deprive them of what are currently rights. So there are rights, for instance, to visits. There are rights to access to newspapers, to information, to some rights to participate in programs, some education goes on, and so on. Much more limited than the general population. And so the proposal is, well, let's make this more miserable so people will not stay in segregation. They don't want people in segregation because it's problematic to administer segregation. You end up with this unit or units and sometimes entire institutions that have to be administered separately. And it does interfere with people participating in their correctional plan. You can't go to the same shops or the same... So work is generally not available. You can't participate in the same program, so they're going to be greatly reduced and so on. So it's a problem to administer. But to simply say we're going to resolve this problem by making it really miserable is astonishing. And to give you an example, I mean, one of the things that upset us a great deal when we were doing our review was when we realized at the very time that this panel was suggesting that the only thing wrong with segregation was that it wasn't tough enough. We had a situation where a young 19-year-old girl strangled herself to death in a segregation cell while being watched by four staff. And the idea that this severely mentally ill and desperate young woman who had been in segregation for well over a year could be in such desperate straits at the same time that they were coming to the conclusion that the circumstances of administrative segregation were too soft, really struck us as being outrageous. Well, what kind of examination did they make of these units? What kind of feedback did they get? In the end, I mean, our sense was that they're playing on this notion, and it seems easy to do in this field, this bizarre notion that people would like to be isolated. We all know in our own lives that much of what gives us life meaning is our association with other people. It's what we seek out. It's what we need. Anyone who works a night shift alone or has been, for some reason, been isolated knows how much you need that kind of social interaction. And yet we're led to believe that all these prisoners just like it that way and choose it. And that the prison administration just goes along with it for no reason. I mean, that's just nonsense. It creates a myth, straw dog in effect, that they set up and then shoot down. In the process, what you've done is you've minimized rights, fundamental rights, that are there to protect people from abuse. And if people in segregation don't need laws that protect them from abuse, I don't know who does.
Yes, definitely. My next question is, many Canadians are worried about gangs, particularly with everything in the mass media and that. And what is the panel's response to this problem?
Well, they're an element in the prison. I mean, the prisons are prisons. They're there. People are there for having committed crimes. Many of them are property crimes, which are obviously painful and hurtful. Others are involved in very serious crime, and gangs are responsible for some very serious crimes in the community, but they're also responsible for a great deal of difficulty within the prisons, most of the drug dealing and other forms of muscling and so on are affected by gangs. Also, rival gangs get involved in serious conflicts within prisons, some prisons more than others, but that's a very serious problem. Everybody understands that that's serious. In the end, corrections has a fair bit of authority about how they segregate people, for instance. There's a great deal of segregation, especially in Quebec, to keep rival gangs apart. But everything that we're concerned about here is, in fact, a crime. The crimes are addressed for groups of inmates the same way they're addressed for individual inmates. And we have to make sure that when we're doing whatever we're doing, it's always premised on what's fair, what's effective, what's just. The way gangs are addressed largely in the report is more to create the notion that prisoners are increasingly unmanageable, that they're much worse than they used to be, and that justifies measures that in the past were considered abusive. And that's been the basis of our concern.
In your report, you write that the panel's approach to drug use is one-dimensional, focusing exclusively on greater enforcement with no sensitivity of consideration to the implications of the measures proposed on the human rights of prisoners and their families to visit and associate. Could you explain what the panel's report proposes and how this will affect prisoners, their families, and even volunteers?
Well, to some extent, the problem of drugs in prison is similar to the problem of drugs in the community. Everybody knows that use of illegal drugs creates all sorts of problems. Aside from the addictions for the individual, it also funds and feeds organized crime, which in turn makes enormous sums of money from the fact that drugs are illegal and therefore they're the sole suppliers. In the community, we have enforcement. We have laws and police that try to find and secure and enforce the laws, but they're not without limits. In prison, we seem to think that we can enforce without limits. So notions like prevention, harm reduction, and treatment were completely ignored by this panel, even though they are, in fact, part of the Correctional Service of Canada's strategy to some extent. The emphasis has always been on enforcement, but this panel had no recommendations for treatment, had no recommendations for harm reduction, and had no recommendations for anything other than enforcement. And the primary set of recommendations that disturbed us were ones that would, in fact, restrict, limit, or prohibit visits or contact visits, which are ones in which people can touch each other. What we're saying is that drugs are important for sure, but you have to put it in some other context. What is the cost of breaking up families? What is the cost of prohibiting visits? We know, for instance, that those who have family support have a much better chance of being successful after release than those who aren't. Would we accept such kinds of limits in the community that because someone was thought to be maybe using drugs or had maybe been in contact or was in contact with somebody else who may have used drugs, that somehow that association should be prohibited? We've also got citizens in the community who want to visit their sons, their fathers, and so on. And they're being subjected to screening, which does not determine that you have drugs, but only determines that you may have been in contact with something that looks like it was drugs. So we have what's called ion scan testing going into prisons, which can find minute, extremely minute amounts of substances that are associated often with drugs. But they also generate false positives. They generate situations where a person is thought to have been in associated with some drug when in fact they were not. The problem with prison is that kind of screening in itself can have huge implications for people. It can result in you not getting to see your wife or your kids or your mother. It can result in your own release being delayed because then there's suspicion that maybe you're involved in the drug trade. So it's a set of rules which, while motivated to keep drugs out, and that's certainly important, if allowed to operate without any concern, reasonable concerns about human rights, can only end up being destructive. And our concern was that this panel was completely myopic. It was simply looking at this as an enforcement problem, gave no consideration to measures in prisons which would reduce the demand for drugs, such as treatment. I mean, one of the things that's a problem in prisons is some people become addicted while they're there. Well, let's look at the circumstances that would lead to that. Why would a person begin to use drugs or move to very serious drugs from less serious ones while they're in prison? Well, one of the reasons is the kind of scanning that they do and the urinalysis testing they do is more likely to find a person who is using marijuana than one who's using heroin. And so to avoid being caught, some inmates, we believe, and I think there's good evidence for this, actually move from the soft drugs to the hard drugs. But let's take a look at that. Let's really say, do we really want to enforce all these drugs to the same level? Are we creating a worse problem than we had in the first place? Those kinds of questions were never considered. They were never talked about. They were never examined. So all of this, our own enforcement policy, at what point does it end up creating more problems than it solves? At what point do we end up interfering with human rights in a way that can't be justified? In the end, we know the only way you can have an absolutely drug-free prison is to have everybody essentially like, totally isolated all the time. When you do that, and there is experience with that, people go insane. They kill themselves. They are far from being rehabilitated. So if you're going to have something less than that, then in fact, whether you like it or not, you're having to make some choices about how far you go. Our problem was that the attitude of this panel was that enforcement of those laws trumps everything else. And our view is that that's a very dangerous attitude to take.
In your report, you spoke with many people within the correctional system on all levels, from guards up to wardens. What would you say that their overall opinion of these 109 recommendations towards ensuring public safety is?
Well, we didn't do a systematic kind of consultation. It was only the two of us. We were doing it on our own. However, both of us have worked in the system for 40 years. We know people within the system and have known them, and we have had many conversations, but we didn't do a systematic kind of consultation on that. It was beyond our scope. But our view is this. We're not going to find the villain within corrections. Correctional staff do, on the whole, what they're expected to do. We've had periods in the past when the system made important strides, positive strides, and we have situations where they seem to be reactive. Well, it's the leadership that determines that. It's Parliament. It's the minister that determines that in the first instance. But our feedback from those we've spoken to is that this was political. It wasn't evidence-based. It's creating enormous problems day by day for their operation. They seem to be undermining many of the things that were important. There are some opportunities here as well. I mean, there are some good things you can do under the rationale or the recommendations of this report. There's still a lot of choice, and I think in some instances on the ground they're actually doing some good things. But my concern is that the report itself, the most important recommendations, are extremely negative. And in spite of the fact that some useful things, for instance, speeding up access to treatment and at intake, doing better, more comprehensive review and trying to expand mental health services in the community are fine. I mean, those are great, and they've been part of the plan all along, as a matter of fact. But when you put in place then criteria for parole that are virtually impossible to meet, when you abolish statutory release, what you're creating is a huge growth in the prison population and serious reductions in access to gradual release. That makes the prison experience much worse. And it also means that the integration of the community is much worse, and everybody pays for that, both prisoner and public.
In the panel's report, The Roadmap to Strengthening Public Security, it states that employment and employability is important to reducing the levels of recidivism. The penitentiaries now focus more on programs that relate to cognitive skills, such as addictions, anger management, etc., in lieu of work training or trades training. What are your thoughts on the roadmap's focus on employment, employability, and how it is to be implemented and how that relates to public safety?
Well, exactly. That's one of the interesting things. But clearly, anybody would agree that preparation for work and having skills is one part of the problem. But the panel seems to think it's the predominant issue, that it outranks other things. When in fact, there's very little research to show that that's the case. For a person that's brain damaged, being able to develop some kind of work skill is not likely to make a difference. For a person that has grade 4 education, it's far more important to get an education than it is to get a particular work skill, if the person's able and willing. The focus on employment is worthwhile if it's done on the basis of the actual needs of the person and the circumstances, what they're facing with. For a lot of people, getting on top of the drinking is the big problem, or the addiction to drugs is the big issue. And so the cognitive programs that address that are far more important than working in a factory setting in the prison for a few years, because those other problems will undermine them. The whole approach to employment also has the problem that it's by far the most expensive kind of program you can operate. If you want to teach people building trades, you have to build something. You can't teach a person to be a bricklayer unless he's actually laying bricks or any other construction trade. If you want a person to learn factory skills, you have to build factories. And if you're going to build factories, you have to have marketing, you have to have research, you've got to have program development, and in order to have produce something that can actually be sold. These are worthwhile programs, but they're very expensive programs, and their benefits are, while there's evidence that they do benefit some people, they're not the grand-scale solution to the problem that the panel seems to think they are. On the other hand, if you take something like education, there's actually quite a bit of research that shows that education reduces recidivism, whether it's education at the lowest level of basic literacy or it's the post-secondary university levels. There's, in Canada, substantial research that points to quite an encouraging result, a dramatic result in some cases, in recidivism. The other thing is that about education is it's actually quite cheap. It's very easy to put together a course. All you need is a teacher who works on an external contract and basically a room and some paper and pencil, a few books. Far, far cheaper than most employment programs. It also allows you to accumulate your education. You can take your grade 9 English in this institution. If you get transferred to another one, they can take your mathematics. It lends itself to the individual kind of planning that you need. But if you're taking a plumbing course in one institution, say a medium, and then you get transferred to a minimum because you're considered a better risk, you will not have that program there. So you'll lose it. You may have spent a year and a half, not enough to actually have learned the skill, but still that's a lot of time into something that may not pan out. So our view is that the focus on employment is really distorted. It's distorted in the sense that we're talking about the most expensive way to keep people active while they're in prison with no evidence that it serves a constructive purpose for all people, only for select people under some circumstances. And if it's at the cost of addressing some really important problems that the person has, such as related to mental illness or illiteracy or addictions, then it, in fact, does not contribute to public safety at all.
What is the current situation for educational opportunities for prisoners, particularly speaking about post-secondary? Because it is my understanding that these educational opportunities have been cut drastically and don't even exist unless, of course, the prisoner, him or herself, pays for it.
Well, what we have now, the upper limit for education that's provided by the institutions is grade 12 or grade 12 equivalency. And there's much debate about what that really means and whether it's really equivalent. And that's been an improvement that going to grade 12 has been an improvement that's only occurred in the last few years. Before that, it was grade 10. But beyond that, aside from a person being able to take correspondence courses in prison for post-secondary at his own expense, there is nothing. But that hasn't always been the case. There was a time when they did have post-secondary education for those inmates that were inclined and able, that could take university courses. It was quite an extensive program at one point. And in fact, after it had been canceled, and it has been canceled, it was canceled in the 80s, a major research project was undertaken to follow up with those that had been in the post-secondary education in British Columbia. And what they found was that not only did it reduce recidivism substantially, but it reduced the greatest effect were those who were considered to be the highest risk. Well, if you have a program that has the greatest effect with those that are the highest risk, and it's a substantial, measurable, real change, then you've got a program that's well worth developing and saving. And to abandon those programs for work programs that have nothing like that same degree of confidence, in our minds, simply reflected again that they weren't looking at the evidence. This idea of working in prison has always appealed to prison administrators and the public. Going right back to the worst conditions in the worst prisons in our history, work was always part of what was thought to be rehabilitative. Now, in those days, the work was things like breaking rocks and turning a wheel, things like that. We've progressed a bit from there, but this is ideological, and we have to get beyond that. We have to look at the evidence. Our concern was that there were two recommendations for education, neither of them significant. There was no mention of post-secondary education, in spite of your own research to that effect. There was no mention of the recent policy to remove computers from prisoners' cells, or at least to not allow them in the future, even though they were being paid for by prisoners themselves. There was none of these other issues that had to do with learning and development were addressed at all, at the expense of this single-minded focus on employment.
You wrote in response to the panel's take on Aboriginal prisoners, a transformation agenda that does not address, as the first priority, the staggering injustice that has been and continues to be inflicted on Aboriginal peoples is not one that a just society should endorse. Why does the panel's transformation agenda not address in issues of Aboriginals, and do you think that it will add to the already staggering incarceration rates, which are over 9 times that of non-Aboriginal Canadians?
Well, yes, it will. The roadmap does have recommendations in respect to programming and some services and employment, particularly for Aboriginals, which in themselves are on its face value are fine. What it doesn't do is address or even recognize the staggering disproportion of Aboriginal people that are in prison. The problem with not recognizing it is that many of the other recommendations they have for the population as a whole will completely undermine the particular recommendations that they had for Aboriginal people, because they are always affected by these changes more than others. So as an example, the measures around gradual release, making this so-called earned, and requiring that elements of a plan be put together, such as a strong likelihood of employment on release, which is probably something that few prisoners could. But you can be sure that Aboriginal prisoners will be less likely to meet those criteria than anyone else. So while they have a few programs, recommend a few programs which are fine for Aboriginals, the fundamental process of gradual release would become increasingly difficult. Now, Aboriginal prisoners already are less likely to obtain parole. They're more likely to serve a greater proportion of their sentence. They're more likely to be released on statutory release as it is. If you put new requirements in that make that whole process much tougher, you can be sure that those with mental illness, those with serious deficits, those who are in minorities, particularly those that traditionally have deprived economic and social circumstances, those are going to communities that have the least infrastructure, such as residences or employment and so on, that are considered necessary for parole to be granted will be the last to get it, or they won't get it at all. So those kinds of massive programs have a huge impact, completely outweigh any benefits of individual programs. And the absence of, in the report, of any recognition of the particular plight and the growing problem, the proportion of Aboriginal people in prison has been growing dramatically over the years. It's not getting better. It's getting much worse. We're talking about incarceration rates for non-Aboriginal people of about 110 per 100,000 in the population. But for Aboriginals, we're talking about 1,000. That's worse than most parts of the United States. It's a staggering difference. And it seemed absurd and unbelievable that a report that's charting the future of corrections in Canada could not bring itself to acknowledge that that is a huge problem that must be addressed, and that you mustn't be coming up with broad recommendations that will inevitably make that worse.
In your report, you wrote, "The panel appears to have been persuaded by the UCCO," and for our listeners, that's the Guards Union, "so the UCCO's submissions that substantial redevelopment of the prison infrastructure is needed in order to impose the control and disciplinary regimes that the union wants to see implemented." How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, we read their brief. We read the report. I mean, what the report, it was very interesting. The union put forward a research study that they had conducted that had not been reviewed by anyone outside of the system, and which on its face seemed to be just not representative of corrections at all. It also contained all sorts of assumptions about how they thought the disciplinary process should work, which was, in fact, beyond the law. It's not how it works. That's fine. I mean, they've got a tough job, and they've got ideas on how they think would work better, and I don't fault them for putting that forward. But the response of the panel was to simply accept it, even though they acknowledge in their own report that they weren't able to confirm any of this information through the Management of Correctional Services of Canada. Well, if you have guards that are saying, well, there's all this violence going on, and there's all these violations of charges going on in the institutions, and the Correctional Services of Canada can't verify that, they can't substantiate it, and indeed they can't. The actual official statistics aren't anywhere close to what the union was claiming. Then it seems to me that there's some reason to at least be cautious. I mean, that would be good grounds maybe to do an independent study. That'd be good reasons to actually look inside and see which set of data actually seems most reliable. But that didn't happen. They simply accepted it in the end. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, there's two problems here. One is that how could it be that the guards have all this data and the correctional administrators don't? I mean, if that's the case, if they're right and administrators are wrong, then you've got a serious problem in terms of the administration of the prison, in which case you should be finding out why they don't have this data. Surely that would be an area that you would want to have some recommendations on. On the other hand, if you can't verify the data, do you rejig the whole system? Well, the reality was that this whole review had been a promise that had been made to police and prison guards long before the first election in which the Conservatives were elected. It was a promise. It was an expectation. And it becomes clear to me, at least as I'm reading the report, that there was this substantial willingness to accept anything plausible that the guards came up with. made that known before the study. It was central. The UCCO had access to the panel that no one else had, that was, or at least to the same degree, who were consulted. Most were limited to 25 minutes. They had 2 hours. They had a 50-page brief. The rest of us were told that we couldn't have anything more than 20 pages. And in any event, it didn't help because we were trying to consult before the report was written and had no idea what we were actually submitting on. Whereas the guards had a very particular agenda that was part of their whole reason for demanding the review in the first place. But so we were concerned, very concerned, that this distorted the whole process. At the same time, there was virtually no opportunity for prisoner participation, or for that matter, virtually anyone else, because, as I said, they never did consult on their actual recommendations. And that's what you want. I mean, it's fine to talk to a panel before they do their report, when all they have is their terms of reference. But what you really want to be talking about are the implications of your recommendations. I have never before seen a commission that made recommendations that were immediately adopted by the ministry involved without any consultation process or any kind of a public vetting process, and especially something that had such dramatic implications for an area of public policy that not all people in the public are aware of, but it does matter to their own well-being. So we had these kinds of anomalies where those that appeared to be telling the government what they wanted to hear were given this deferential kind of reception, whether they had any evidence or not, whether the evidence could be verified or not, whether the evidence was consistent with the other research or data that was kept with the system. And that, to our mind, was a distortion, a smack of raw politics rather than a thoughtful public policy process.
Would you have any other comments in regards to the panel's report on the physical infrastructure and regional complexes?
Well, that's an interesting one. What they did in the report is they recommended that we replace existing prisons with large regional complexes that it have within them 4 or 5 prisons, and all of the recommendations had to do with efficiencies and cost. There was no analysis of the actual implications in other respects of putting prisons within a common fence and having common services developed. Probably the more part of this that's particularly troubling is whether or not you buy the argument that large prisons are more efficient than small prisons. The whole argument that this was to replace existing old prisons is extremely doubtful. One would think that if you were looking ahead for the future of corrections in Canada, and particularly prisons, one of the things you try to do is estimate how many people are likely to be in the prison. What's your need going to be? They made absolutely no attempt in this report to estimate the changes in the prison population that would occur even with their own recommendations, let alone look at the other areas of public policy, such as sentencing, that this government has introduced. They've introduced numerous bills that bring in mandatory minimum sentencing, which is going to have significant impact. There's a bill before the House right now that has to do with how many days of credit one gets off their sentence for time served in prison before their trial.
Would you have the number of that bill?
C-25. The Commissioner of Corrections was before the Senate just the other day, and he was on this, but they were asking him, what are your estimates of the impact that this would have on the prison population? And his answer was, that's a cabinet secret. But what I can tell you is that it's dramatic. It's a substantial change. And I can also say that we've been promised to have the funding to expand imprisonment to accommodate that. Well, we just can't help but believe that without the numbers, which apparently exist, but for some reason are thought not to be something that the public should have access to, what we're going to see is simply substantial expansion of prison and be very little replacement of prisons. So, in fact, what we end up with is a plan to build a lot of big prisons to accommodate the growth in prison that this panel's recommendations and the direction of this government with sentencing is going. That then begs the question. The question never gets asked: does this really translate into public safety? does having a big prison system make it safer than a small one? And for the answer, the simple answer to that is to look at the United States. The United States has 7 people in prison for every 1 person that's in prison in Canada. It's enormous. It's the biggest prison system in the world. It's grown entirely in the last 30 years. Prior to that, the prison system in the United States was approximately equivalent to ours on a per capita basis. That's occurred entirely because of the politics around sentencing and corrections. The measures that were introduced were mandatory minimums at the one end in terms of sentencing and restrictions on release through parole at the other end. We now have states that spend more on their prisons than on post-secondary education. We've got states that are in a financial crisis. California is the best example, where the prison population has grown so large, and the prison guard union has become so influential in the political process that they're in an absolute crisis. It's interesting. California just recently also impaneled a group to review their corrections, and in particular with a view to reducing their prison population areas because it's so out of control. The group that they impaneled, they called an expert panel, and it was an expert panel, unlike the panel in Canada, which had some people with some interesting related experience. I'm not saying that they didn't have any expertise, but very limited. But in comparison to the California panel, it was dramatic. What they're arguing is to undo the very kinds of measures that the Canadian panel is recommending. So we have this absurd situation where Canada is recommending measures that are at their foundation are the same kinds of measures that California adopted that created this crisis that they're in. Well, California has another panel, by the way, which also calls their report a roadmap. It's recommending that they move back towards the system that's much closer to Canada. And amongst the very first credits that they give in terms of research, because they're very strong on the research side, are Canadian researchers. So it just seems to me the irony of this is astonishing, that we end up with one roadmap that's saying we should be more like California, and another one that says in California this, we should be more like Canada. And while these reports and papers themselves don't ensure that anything in particular will necessarily happen, it's very clear in California, it's very clear in this own expert panel that the problems that were created in California were not occasioned by crime. It was created by the politics that allowed the state to develop a corrections and sentencing system which grew completely out of control. Once you once as public policy, politicians tell the public that harsh measures of imprisonment, long measures of imprisonment, tough sentencing is the solution to public safety, then there is no limit. Then as crime continues, it simply justifies more of the same. And it just grows and grows and grows. And so you ended up with all sorts of draconian sentencing provisions, some that resulted in people who had committed fairly minor property crimes getting life sentences. Well, that's what happens. It took them 30 years to go from where we are right now, the direction we're taking, to where they are today. And it just seems so tragic to me that with that stark example, you've got this enormous prison system, and they still have violent crime that's 3 times ours. Although I should say that changes in crime in both Canada and the United States have been dropping over the last 20 years in exactly the same pattern. Not necessarily at the same level, but the same pattern. It appears that regardless of what kind of a justice system they have, what really influences crime is other things. It's got to do with demographics, the economy, other sorts of social policies appear to be far more influential in actually determining crime rates than anything you do in the criminal justice system. And if you think about it, that maybe isn't too surprising when you consider that the criminal justice system doesn't even get involved until after a crime is committed, unless there's solid evidence that shows that what we do while the person is within the justice system actually makes them less likely rather than more likely to commit a crime after release. The justice system, at its very best, has no impact at all.
For my last question, could you shed some light on what Bill C-43 is?
Well, C-43 is the first bit of legislation that four corrections that's been brought before the House since the roadmap was released. And it's the government says that it's their first installment in this kind of review. So they're bringing in some measures that would begin to change the language of the Act. It would remove, for instance, removes reference to least restrictive measures. It doesn't directly talk about eliminating certain rights and making them privileges, because that's clearly unconstitutional, but it does have language in the bill around incentives and control and regimes and authority, which could well translate into that happening without saying it explicitly. So that this is a first step. They have not, at this point, the bill doesn't contain the abolition of statutory release, but the government is claiming continuously that that's their intent. The reason that they've not taken that step is because even they recognize that the costs would be phenomenal, and they're both in terms of the cost of building new prisons, but also the implications in the interim of a huge prison population buildup before you can get your prisons ready, and that will make the management of the prisons and anything that remotely looks like programs or employment or whatever increasingly difficult to actually deliver, and at huge costs. We are putting a lot more money into the prison system. There's been a lot of promises made and commitments to build facilities and to expand certain programs. Virtually all of the initial money, the first $125 million that went in, was entirely focused on enforcement. There will be some other elements, but in effect, this is the first installment on the vision that was created in the roadmap.
As an expert on prison issues with 38 years with the John Howard Society, I thank you, Mr. Graham Stewart, for explaining what is behind these 109 recommendations in the roadmap to strengthening public safety and for informing the public on these issues.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to explain this in some detail. That's not a common event in the broadcast media, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.